I'm delighted to welcome Professor Dr. Matthew Longo, who is Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Leiden in the Netherlands. He did his PhD at Yale University, I think, and is also was a research fellow at St. Anne's College as well. And he's here to talk this evening on an absolutely fascinating topic, quite extraordinary, how these tiny moments in history cause an extraordinary ripple effect. Who'd have thought a picnic in 1989 could have started that domino chain that leads to the fall of the Iron Curtain? So I'm sure you're as excited as I am. Please give Dr. Matthew Longo a really warm welcome.
Thank you. So, two prefatory notes. The first is that tiny little addendum to the bio, I'm really happy to say, proud, excited. The book just got nominated as a finalist for the Orwell Prize for political writing, which is all really new. But second little addendum is that I did the school's talk, and I was really excited to speak to young people. But, you know, trying to explain what the 80s is like to that crowd is quite hard, because not only is it distant, it's unimaginable. I don't think that's our problem. Looking out, you look like precisely my demographic. So we're going to go back in time briefly. This is hopefully a fun little story. What I hope you accept it as is precisely that, a story. I interviewed people. I did 6 years of, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours of interviews with all these actors. And I'm going to distill it into a tale that I hope is dramatic and riveting. It should be upsetting. It should be thrilling. It should be all those things. But it is not going to be dry history. So just so you're aware, if you'd like to get a beer, bring it to the table. I find that completely context appropriate. Okay. So the 80s. You have to take yourself not just back in time, but to a particular place. This is not 80s England. I'm a child of the 80s in the United States. None of these things work. This book, The Picnic, okay, it's called Dream of Freedom, The Collapse of the Iron Curtain, is going to take you through to the collapse of what was then, still is in memory, one of the greatest institutions of oppression in the world. But the location is really important to start the story. So this is a map of what we're talking about. Most of you have some idea of the contours of the Iron Curtain. It's the kind of dark black line cutting through the map. You have an idea that there was once not one Germany, but two. East was communist, West was capitalist or liberal. And in the Eastern Bloc, you had a couple countries of which Hungary was one. But Hungary, the western part of Hungary, abuts Austria. That part is the Iron Curtain part, which is where all the action is going to take place. But because I want to transport you, we have to start somewhere else. If you notice on the map, if you can identify Hungary, it's kind of plop in the middle. All the way to the east of Hungary is a town called Debrecen. This town is not only far from the Iron Curtain and far from the West, it's really close to what was then the border of the Soviet Union, what is now the border of Ukraine. Okay? So we're really far east. The reason this matters is that to try to transport yourself into the 80s isn't just thinking about a world without cell phones and internet and things like that. It's a world without information. Budapest, the capital, maybe there were murmurs of truths that weren't just official news from the newspapers in Budapest that, of course, got their news from Moscow. But if you're out in Debrecen, way out in the peripheries on the border of the Soviet Union, there was no news. You were in an area that historians will call information deserts. So the story doesn't just take place in the late 80s. It takes place in a space, a zone, where the idea that we lived in the world we thought of the 80s, post-Gorbachev, a time of possible change, was frankly impossible to believe. You had heard a whiff of rumor that, oh, maybe there's some new Soviet premier who believes in change or something. No one believed in anything. This was the world you grew up in, and it was the world you thought you would die in. This is the setting. And the place is really important to get into the minds of these characters. I'm going to transport you to begin with into the head of a man named Ferenc, which is like Frank in Hungarian. Ferenc Mészáros. In Debrecen, this guy's young, late 20s, early 30s. stuck, failed out of school, got involved in gangs, no job prospects, no ambitions, nowhere to channel his energies. So what does he do? He ends up basically in street gangs. We're not talking like fancy gangs, like Mexican cartels. We're talking about 10 guys over there and 10 guys over here beating each other up on weekends, because what else could you do? These were people completely drummed down by the lack of possibility in their future out in Debrecen. Just a little bit more of context. So this is what the Iron Curtain actually looked like. This matters. Because also, one of the great pleasures of writing a book, many of you perhaps have written books, is you get to hire cartographers to like draw you your own special map, which may be the coolest thing in the whole world. So the outer border, the little thin one, is what the border Hungary and Austria looks like. But the Iron Curtain actually doesn't traverse the border. The Iron Curtain is several kilometers inland. At parts. You'll see at parts it gets closer. Obviously, there's rough terrain. Not all the terrain is equal. Why? Because what is the Iron Curtain really? It's not just a border. It's kilometers-wide expanse of security installation. We're talking about guards and dogs and watchtowers and barbed wire and electric fence, all these things. And had you been a generation earlier, landmines. But those were cleared away, thank God, because had they not been, this story is a bloodbath. So the Iron Curtain, it's important to understand, is this zone of what was what's often called a death strip or so forth. You don't want to get caught in, and frankly was uncrossable. In our day, the closest kind of border that looks like this is like the DMZ between North and South Korea. This kind of incredible expanse, this thick expanse of security. Okay, what did it look like? It looked like this. Nothing particularly scary, actually. It's just like a fence with some tower. And then there's areas with electricity and barbed wire. Don't worry about it. All you need to know, we're going to go back to Debrecen, is this is the context. So now in Debrecen, our man, Ferenc, whom I now love, who had a thick, bushy mustache, perfect, 80s activist, rebel, played guitar in his house, Rolling Stones only, whatever. Ferenc starts to get involved in 88 in a group called the MDF, which is, at the time, there were no parties in Hungary. This is an authoritarian system. There is no multi-party democracy. But in 88, Hungary starts to liberalize a bit. It's a little bit different than a lot of its peers. It was one of the more open of the socialist states. And they allow things that are kind of party-like, which is to say that they basically allow groups. They can't run for office, they have no power, they have no rights, they have no privileges, but they're still kind of like parties. MDF, Magyar, Hungarian Democratic Forum. He gets involved. That's 88. He starts to become active. His political life opens. Suddenly, not just music and beating up his friends. He sees something to do. And in the spring of 89, something very important happens to him, which is that, and the name should ring a bell, Otto von Habsburg comes into town. Habsburg, Habsburg Empire, Austro-Hungarian Empire, the man who would have been heir to the entire empire had it not folded, comes to Debrecen. And he comes to give a talk about democracy, freedom, all these beautiful ideas, open Europe, crossing country borders, I mean, fantasies. And Ferenc, who grew up in this information desert, like the other 2,000 people in this room, is just awestruck. Even better, afterwards, they go to dinner. And they go to dinner, and this is really important, they go to dinner in the fanciest hotel in Debrecen, of course. It's Otto von Habsburg. I mean, he's not backpacking, right? Which has a dining room. The dining room, for those of you who like classical music, I mean, Béla Bartók played in this dining room. This is one of Hungary's cultural institutions. Importantly for Ferenc, the dinner had tablecloths, which is a really fancy signifier. When he finished his glass of wine, a waiter would come and refill it. These were things he had never experienced in his life. And they're having a chat about all these ideas about freedom, and they're all getting drunk. They're in their 20s. with an aristocrat, with free wine. I mean, it's a total party. There's like 10 students and the old guy. Okay. At one point, after a bunch of drinking, Ferenc gains his liquid courage and just blurts out, "This is great, but I don't want to be in a fancy place with having this conversation. If you want to affect change, you have to go. You have to go to where the people are, and you have to do it in a place that protests something. I think we should throw a party." His word was a picnic on the site of the Iron Curtain. And everyone laughed, because what an incredibly insane idea. Absolute laughter, peals, everyone's having their wine glasses refilled. That was a great one, Ferenc, you know, good one. Next week, meeting of the MDF, this party, full room, activists. He's like, okay, wrong crowd. I'm going to bring it up again. He can't let go of the idea. It's going to be a party at the site of the Iron Curtain. He has this this vision. Says the idea. The party is like, next, you know, obviously. But this time something changes, which is this young woman, her name is Maria Philip, basically raises her hand and said, look, I'll help you. Afterwards, Maria and Ferenc get together. The whole thing makes no sense, not just because it's insane, but also they have no money, they have no vehicles, they have no food. Also, they have no way to communicate with people. It's not just they had no cell phones, no one had landlines. So one of the great distinctions of authoritarian states is how you manage communications. Famously, Ceaușescu, Romania, one of the craziest dictators of the era, loved his citizens having phones. That way he can listen in. Hungary didn't do that. It said you shouldn't have phones at all. Nobody had a phone. How could you possibly plan a party with no money and no communication hundreds of kilometers to the west? A. And B, with no idea what that would even look like. To give you some context, the reason I showed you this idea of the Iron Curtain as this bandwidth, right? This like curvilinear bandwidth of security. You can't throw a picnic there. And even if you did, his idea was that there'd be Hungarians on one side and Austrians on the other, like tossing over sausages and beer. Like completely insane. Okay. That's the first bit of setup. I swear it's all going to come together. But there's a lot of setup for the story. All of this would be absolutely insane and have led to a prison sentence that would have ended everyone's lives had you not had at least something permissive about the state. So the other of, there's three important segments of the story. The second segment is this really important fact, which is that it's not actually that random that Hungary is where this happened. Because in Hungary, it was starting to liberalize. Why? Because their prime minister was a man named Miklos Nemeth. Incidentally, I would hazard, having now spoken to a lot of rooms in a similar demographic, few of you even heard this name, Miklos Nemeth. To give you an idea of how important historically Miklos Nemeth is towards 89 and the end of the Iron Curtain, in 2009, 20th year anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall, the city of Berlin put up giant foam dominoes, okay, across the whole line of the Berlin Wall. And they asked two people to push them, so they all collapsed. One of those people was Miklos Nemeth, meaning the Germans understand what he did for the fall of the Berlin Wall, but he's not part of our lexicon, at least in Anglophone American and UK universities and education. Miklos Nemeth was a reformer, and Miklos Nemeth had a vision, which is that Hungary could become something like the middle space between East and West. And he went to Gorbachev. He's like, Gorbachev, you're a reformer, I'm a reformer. We'll stay communist, but with a multi-party democracy. And Gorbachev said, you know, get out. Like, no way. Because obviously, if you have a democracy and there's an election and the communists lose, they're out. Gorbachev understood that. So did Nemeth, but that was what he was trying to do. So Gorbachev says no. And Nemeth asks a question, which is, okay, here's what I need to know. What if I just do it? What if I start to make reforms, and in particular reforms to the Iron Curtain, because I want to liberalize Hungary, and I can't do that unless I have an economy, unless I have an open border that I can modify trade, import, export, everything. And Gorbachev replied something really important, which is, look, I don't condone this, but I won't send tanks. Which is his way of saying that what happened in 56, which had been an absolute massacre in Hungary, wouldn't happen again. And so Nemeth comes back home, first of all, with wind in his sails, right? Thinking, okay, this is great. I got everything I wanted. I can do what I want. But with a new fear, which is he understood then how constrained Gorbachev's reform really was, in part because Gorbachev had all these hardliners breathing down his neck. So Nemeth came home with a fear, aside from the obvious excitement, I'm going to go and start to affect liberal changes, progressive changes, but also an urgency. I better do this quickly, because this is the moment. If there's a coup in Moscow, sure, Gorbachev's head rolls, but so does mine, right? Who do you make an example of? Some Hungarian idiot who's like, oh, let's have a democracy. And obviously, he's not going to last a week. So Nemeth, who's actually really quite a brave figure in this story, says, okay, I have carte blanche right now. This is contemporaneous with the Otto von Habsburg, it's not quite true, June and May, but roughly the same time period. He comes back from Moscow, and he says, what we're going to do is we are going to start to cut the wiring of the Iron Curtain. We're going to test how true this is. That means, A, cutting the barbed wire and rolling it up, and B, turning off the electricity, like as literally, quite literally with an on-off switch, okay? Outside of town, there's like a generator outside a town called Hedzisalom, near what's now the border of Slovakia, was then the border of Czechoslovakia and Austria, tripartite border. So he has this incredibly wild idea. But then it's not random in that context that my totally beloved young people throwing their party aren't ending up in prison. They're making, you know, they're finally making connections. They get a bus. Someone had a bus. Another guy knew a pig farmer who was willing to donate, like, pigs so they could roast bacon. I mean, these are 20-somethings throwing a party. Like, let's not make it more than it is. It's a protest and all that stuff, but they want to build a stage. They actually build picnic tables. This is, like, the perfect venue for this story. They want to build this. It just happens to be on the Iron Curtain, right? But none of that could happen if you didn't have someone like Nemeth who hears about the picnic and basically says, this is perfect. I'm going to already start to dismantle the Iron Curtain. But if they want to help, if the Soviets move, I can be like, look, wasn't me, it's these guys. Right? That's what he's doing. It's politician. Nemeth is a hero, but he's a total politician. He's looking at a bunch of scraggy-haired, like I told you, you know, thick mustached mullet, 80s look guys and girls. I mean, these total raggedy looking party throwing activisty types. And he's saying, this is just perfect. Okay, those are the two. Third part of the story. Oops, sorry. Nope, wrong way. You'd think I would know green means forward. Whatever. Not quite. Chapter two. The third part of the story is that while there's this talk of reform throughout the East, everybody knew about Gorbachev in a way, in some form. What Nemeth did in May, when he turned off the electricity, sent a shockwave around the world. Front page New York Times, who cares? Front page local nowhere gazette in the hills of Moravia. Everyone knew. Front page news, what he did. And of the socialist states, I've talked about Hungary as this kind of socialist pasture, right? It's a place of good wine, and everyone loves Hungary. It's kind of like an easy place. There's a kind of a liberalism in Hungary and progressiveness and all these things. East Germany was the opposite. I mean, maybe you've seen like a film like The Lives of Others kind of film, and have an idea of what the Stasi were, what they represented. East Germany was incredibly clamped down. But suddenly in May, there's this little hope, which is that, okay, if they're cutting the Iron Curtain, maybe we can run through. Maybe something's happening. And there was just this urge to just go, to find out. Anyways, in the summer, Germans would flock to Hungary. Again, good wine, good food, generally progressive. A giant inland lake called Lake Balaton, if you've ever been, it's spectacular, it's beautiful. But this summer in particular, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of East Germans just start to flood Hungary. Because there's just this hope. If this is happening, who knows? They don't know anything. They know nothing except this one gesture, this turning off the electricity. And that's enough to inspire the hope to let's just try. Okay, those are the three actors. August, July, planning, bacon, building a stage, getting the bands, party. But most importantly, the movement west. So you start to have all my Hungarian activists move unidirectionally from Debrecen out east towards where it'll be held, a place called Sopron on the western border, the Iron Curtain. Contemporaneously, all the king's men, so to speak, cutting up the Iron Curtain. And contemporaneously, hundreds of thousands of East Germans coming and just flooding campsites just to see. August, the planning happens, and we start to get some magic because it's all working. They can actually find a venue inside the Iron Curtain. They're thrilled. But contemporaneously, East Germans are getting caught because, in fact, the border was not open. There was just the outer line was cut. And there were all the guards and all the dogs and all the other layers of fencing. So I spent a lot of time in the Stasi archives for this project, just to give you what it looked like. So when the Stasi would catch someone, they would, of course, interrogate them. That's what the Stasi did best. They're the interrogators supreme of the 20th century. And one thing they did is they tried to understand not just why people were running away, but particularly how they could perfect the art of catching them, meaning they made them, under great duress, draw maps of what they thought they were doing, how they were going to escape. This guy, it's all redacted. It's all blackened out for privacy reasons. I don't know his name. He just goes by the name of M in the book. It's made up. It could be anything. M is caught. M is one of the original run of people in May and June and July who are caught by the thousands, basically like lemmings, just absolutely walking into the woods, literally the woods, looking for a border and finding a guard. This is what M had on him. He's like, okay, they're cutting the electric fencing. Here's what I need to get to the west. I need a counter to check that the currency's gone so I don't electrocute myself, and a shovel in case I have to dig something. This was his idea of how he was going to make it the west. Dead on arrival. Thousands of stories like this. The archives are filled with the ex post interrogations of caught East Germans. This was an incredibly dangerous project. I throw this in because a lot of the story is going to get kind of exciting and positive. I don't want you to think it's actually that positive. It's a really messy story. And like all revolutions and rebellions, there's a lot of bad bits. And one of the bad bits is people came with that hope that didn't manifest. So this is what explains the setup of what's going to happen. You have to understand, at this point already, the campgrounds are filled and the woods are filled with thousands upon thousands of these Germans getting caught, passports taken, data taken, often put in vans, put in prison in Hungary, and then deported back to East Germany to end up in a prison. It was a very difficult period of time. So, with that said, it is literally gunfire. Literally gunfire in the woods, okay? I feel like you being on picnic tables with gunfire, this is like the most perfect setting. Now if only there was like some person in like a strangely, you remember, because it wasn't uniformed. The Stasi would be like undercover, but wearing like awkward suits. They'd be in like all black with sunglasses in the corner, and everyone would be in like colors and shorts, and they'd all look at him like, who's that guy? If only someone could like appear, we'd be perfect. Maybe it's him. Okay. So they start putting up flyers. Why would you put up flyers? Because you're throwing a party. How are people going to know to go to your party if you don't tell them? But because of this whole Iron Curtain thing, they have a little sign in Hungarian that says, cut it and take it. Meaning, now that the Iron Curtain is, the barbed wire is being rolled up, bring some wire cutters. Take a souvenir home. What a great party. Again, these Hungarians, like, a lot of authoritarianism is about seeing how far you can go before you hit the wall and then stepping back. But these guys keep testing the line, and they never face resistance. I mean, putting up a sign that says, cut the Iron Curtain your damn self and take it home is, like, unimaginable. But anyways, state wasn't stopping them. So bottom line, these posters are everywhere. Everyone around Sopron in the whole areas see this poster. Importantly, so do the people in all the camps. And the people in the camps are East Germans. And there's this sign, incidentally, also in German. Why? Because they invited Austrians. The whole idea was that Austrians would come into Hungary for the party. It was going to be a Hungarian-Austrian party called the Pan-European Picnic, where that just meant Hungarians and Austrians. That was the whole concept. Okay. Put them out in German, passed around, flyers everywhere. It's summer. Everyone's in their 20s. Everyone's, like, super motivated to make it a great party. August 19th comes, day of the party. Nemeth is terrified. Nemeth spends the 3 days of around the party basically awake, listening to the radio, because internal radio wires. Because the largest Soviet fort in Hungary, okay, tens of thousands of troops, including tanks, is 30 kilometers away. Nemeth is just waiting for it to get squashed. 19th comes, doesn't get squashed. It's literally a party. It is a massive honking party with a grandstand and picnic tables and booze, and everyone's having a great time. And they set this up with the presumption that at 3 o'clock, the borderline would be open to Austrians going east. Right? Austrians who are allowed to go east. West to east, not a problem. East to west, forbidden. Austrians coming east for this party. And at 2:57, 3 minutes before the scheduled opening of the border, a massive horde of East Germans rush the border. And we don't have an exact figure, somewhere between 600 and 1,500, let's say, people rush the border. And at the border were border guards with their guns who have their entire adult professional lives had the task of making sure people don't cross. Like all the people who had just been caught, all those East Germans that ended up in the Stasi records. That is their job. And here they're standing facing this massive crowd, and they let them pass. And so you have a scene that looks like this. This unbelievable moment in history that could have been a total bloodbath. Look at the movement of the bodies, this euphoria. On the other side of that fence is literally Austria. It's freedom. It's the West. Look at this guy. I mean, I feel like I know this guy. This guy who brought his entire life in a black plastic shopping bag. These hugs, the pain on the faces, kids. I particularly love this image. So on the one hand, you have a party. And on the other hand, what it's done is set the table for what was the first great border breach in the history of the Iron Curtain. That moment, something like 1,000 people cross. And then every single night, day after day after day, at night, whole campgrounds would empty of people. And they would flood into the woods looking for the border. Because now, the cat was out of the bag. And generally speaking, what they encountered was Hungarian guards that really didn't care. Hungarian guards who didn't care so much, they would hold paper in their pockets with an arrow, because they didn't speak German, showing which way to the border. We're talking like unbelievable complicity on all levels. It was this edifice, this institution of authority was unraveling at a rate you could not imagine. Night of the 19th, night of the 20th, night of the 21st, 22nd, 23rd, and on the 23rd is the last death of the Iron Curtain. Because not every Hungarian border guard was looking the other way. One felt attacked, got scared, and killed someone. The last death, his name is Jan Werner Schulz, August 23rd. Nemeth, who had actually been thrilled at all this, again, like, people are doing his work for him. Nemeth is thrilled, freaks out. Because if there's one, I mean, this could be an international incident. There could be 10, there could be 50. There could be border guards who band together that don't like the state unraveling. Nevertheless, someone in the Soviet yards going, you know, Rambo. And Nemeth says, there's no way this can sustain. If they're crossing on their own, we just have to open the border. You know, we'll see what happens. And so he does something incredibly brave. This is the walkway to Austria, by the way. This is the sign, I'm two slides behind. This is the sign the Austrians put up, like, you're in Austria, like, we'll help you, come over here. Borderstone, okay, oops, this is the campgrounds that literally looks like chalk. Be honest, this is completely a chalk-consistent aesthetic, right? Okay, sorry. Also, beaten up Trabants. Sorry, I got ahead of myself. On a couple days later, after 23rd, Nemeth says we're gonna open the border, and on September 11th, he just gives the order. And at midnight that night, a queue of tens of thousands, 30,000 within the first something like 48 hours, of cars are just leaving. They're just leaving and leaving and leaving. No one's stopping them. It looks like this. People are queuing. I mean, miles and miles of queue, right? To get to this border with all the media of the world and these kinds of faces, these happy, disbelieving, impossible feelings of freedom. September 11th is 3 weeks after the picnic, and within 2 months, the Berlin Wall falls. Why? The Berlin Wall, for those of you who've studied it or know anything about it, the Berlin Wall was there to keep East Germans in, right? It wasn't a defensive wall. It was a restrictive wall, like the wall of a prison, right? What's the point of having a wall keeping Germans in if they can just leave another way? So the moment the border opens anywhere in the Iron Curtain, there's this flood that gets uncontrollable. 2 months later, the wall falls. So this story, this is the 30th anniversary in Sopron. They raised a Trabant over the city square. This story takes you in a very, very direct way from an impossible idea through an incredibly treacherous course into changes that are legitimately global, right? Absolute world-changing events. And part of what's nice about the story, if you care at all about history, is that most history is told top-down. It's mostly about big leaders. If you think about your own education, certainly in schools or university, but probably later reading books, almost everything you encounter is probably going to focus or foreground Gorbachev or Bush, big players, England, France, all these states. And these people, not just the nobodies, like Ferenc and Maria looking for a party, even Nemeth, the prime minister, are unknown figures. And so one of the revelations of the project is that when you hear about how small actions really, like butterfly's wings, right? The small actions can lead to huge changes, right? It's so interesting to see it, right? It's not just that after 2 months, nothing. 2 months is a hiccup of time. In 2 months from the opening of the border, the Berlin Wall falls. It's not even just that. It's that what happens after the picnic? Almost immediately in Leipzig, in East Germany, there start to be very small protests against the Stasi. They're called Monday marches that start a week or two after the opening and grow and grow and grow and grow from the initial one that was early October that had about 1,000 people in which everyone ended up in Stasi prisons to the final one the week before the wall fell that had 500,000 people in Alexanderplatz in Berlin. Nobody could have stopped that. Once it gets that big, there's nothing you can do. And so watching that process of essentially inevitability as these small sparks grow, the two lessons, the one being that all those things we think are impossible are way less impossible than you think, but the other being that the idea that small sparks alone can't do anything, sure, it's right to some degree, a lot of luck involved, right? It's not random it happened in Hungary. It's not random it happened when you had a permissive state. But the idea that small actors can make great changes is so palpable. That's the first bit, so I kind of want to wrap up since I've already talked for a while. But the second is that part of the project is to map this forward to the present. So 89, again, you're my demographic. You all remember not just the Berlin Wall falling and the moment. You probably also remember the feeling. And the dominating feeling of 1989 was something like euphoria, right? It was the collapse of the old systems of authority. It was the victory of liberalism and democracy and freedom. But if you look now at the present, it's not like it's not like liberalism is doing that great, right? No one thinks that this is like the peak of liberalism. Now we live in a world totally broken by inequality, for example. Inequality that since the fall of the Cold War has really taken off. And in the East, you're seeing a total reversion back to authoritarianism. It's not just Orban in Hungary, it's actually across the East. So a lot of the promise of 89, this beautiful moment in time, feels betrayed. Why? And so mapping forward allows you... There's a really loud sound that just turned off. I feel like I went from like having to yell over like a buzz of 1,000 bees to suddenly like talking too loud and not having to. Like that moment in like the elevator when you walk in and like everyone's quiet and you're loud voiced. Okay, excuse me. I will now speak in a more reasonable tone. You have this incredible realization that a lot of what happened is that 89 changed systems. It really changed systems. But the idea that what would happen is that the East would fall and become free like the West didn't really happen in the East, right? The East is not like in a great position. A lot of it is that. What happened? Overnight, systems changed and markets opened. Since we're in England, Hungary has no supermarket chain. There's no national supermarket chain. Who is their supermarket chain? Tesco, right? That's true of all their industries. So capitalism in its predatory form, not its form linked to ideas of freedom and liberalism, democracy, all the hoped for things, that moment wasn't actually so simple as there's freedom here, non-freedom collapses, it'll all become freedom. Actually, certainly in the East, you had all these problems emerge from how quickly transition happened, how quickly you changed to democratic systems before they were ready, how quickly and how unregulated privatization occurred, right? But you also had the same in the West, which is that so much of the social welfare systems that were really strong, certainly in the West we think of, meaning US, UK, France, Italy, all the classic Western states, a lot of why they thrived was precisely because there was an ideological peer. Globalization meant rapid expanse, and that rapid expanse, you can ask any economist, matches exactly the rise in inequality, right? All the predatory market shifts that changed the East also changed the West. And so to give an example of one of the stories, one of the interlocutors, so you have all these East Germans that fled, they had this euphoric moment, this unbelievably powerful moment, only to get into the West and find out that the West wasn't exactly what they had dreamed, right? The dream of freedom and the lived practice of freedom were different. And so part of the lesson of the book are the kind of inspirational things that I left with before about these feelings that impossible things aren't impossible and that small actions can make great waves, right? The proverbial stone being plopped into a pond. But on the other hand, that a lot of the troubles we have now, in particular with liberty in the East and inequality in the West, were exacerbated by that same moment of rupture we otherwise celebrate. And so the two sides of that revelation, the one being these kind of powerful inspirational moments, but the other being the realization about when we start to look critically at our present, how much of it comes from that same moment that we also celebrate. So that's the way the book ends. It ends by thinking a little bit about how did we get to a point from tearing down walls, right, to building them back up? How did we get from getting rid of authoritarian Hungary to Orban and so forth? So that's it. Thank you. And I would like to say 20 minutes for Q&A, exactly on time. Just to the second.
Hello, thank you for that great talk. I was just wondering, you said that when Nemes first said to cut the border and everything, that the pictures went around the world.
Yeah.
What was the reaction from the outside world? And how did it affect Gorbachev and state?
Yeah, so there's this was so carefully controlled. Nemes was so scared at what he was doing. And so what they did is they made it really public. But really public in the sense that they set things up to have this big publicity event, but they set it up in a way that both the CIA and the KGB would have known, right? They made a private, invisible, but kind of visible lead up to the cutting, knowing that if the KGB knew and they didn't do anything, they probably had license. But the pyrotechnics involved in this, it's towing a very fine line. And then in June, they actually did a photo op where they got the foreign minister of Hungary and the foreign minister of Austria to stand together with like giant scissors and like big smiles and suits, like this kind of like crazy image. It looks like you're opening a middle rung Staples in Ohio with like a red ribbon. This is what, American. I'm sure there's an English equivalent, but that's what it looked like. These kind of opening ceremonies where there's like the mayor of a small town comes and cuts a wire. It was like that. Because they were managing, they wanted to get this image out there. So whereas the first image was mostly for the KGB, the second image was for the world. Very carefully managed.
What happened to Nemes in the end?
Yeah, wonderful question. He is now in his 70s. He is he's a little bit like the idiom of like the boxer that never leaves the ring. I spent days with Nemes. Really, one of the pleasures of this kind of research, you get to sit. I met him in his house in Balaton, overlooking the sunset, eating like his grapes. I mean, it's kind of like idyllic settings. And he's like a fussy grandparent. But the moment you talk about the 80s, he has this reversion to form. He actually, he has like the posture of a boxer. And he actually stands and he talks, but like his chest puffs out a little bit. He gets really animated. Because, look, whenever you've had all the power in the world to suddenly be a grandpa, that was a big shift. So there's, in general, this stepping away from power thing. But there's this other thing, which is that he was aware of what was going to happen, right? Nemes is sitting, he has all the information no one has. And also, importantly, he was an economist. He has a degree from the best economics program in Hungary, from Karl Marx University, obviously. but he was a rising economist in the system. He was a well-respected Hungarian economist before becoming a politician. And he had two bits of feedback, pieces of advice in transition Hungary, which is, one, don't democratize so quickly. And everyone looked at him like, ha, 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 are you kidding? Oh, the old communist wants to stay in power, right? Like, he basically said, give me a year. Give me a year, let me set up a new economy. So the fundamentals of the economy precede political infighting. If you don't make the economy first, whoever wins the election is going to make the economy in their favor. And then if they lose, the new people make their own economy in their favor because there wasn't a structure in place prior to politics. He calls it the Spanish model. I'm not a historian of Spain. Apparently, that's what happened after Franco. He said in 90, and we have all these records, I mean, he's a politician. It's not like when I'm hanging out with these Germans. There's no documents, right? I have to believe them when they said, these are the section of woods we ran through. With Nemeth, it's public. I mean, he's a political figure. He basically said, what's going to happen is that you're creating a system in which we liberalize too quickly. Everyone who wins the election will take all of the profit from privatization, become hugely corrupt, and completely screw over the country, which is exactly what happened. A. But B, he had another bit, and that's the part that kind of Hungarians should think about a little bit, because it's quite real what he said. And obviously, none of these pro-democratic parties were going to listen to the old communist saying, you know, give me another year. That sounds like a parody of like, you know, baby, give me just one more chance. And it's kind of like, right, like, come on, shut up. But the second thing, and this is what's more relevant for the West or us here, is he basically said, there's no way you can do this transition unless you do another version of like a Marshall Plan, right? Where you just, it's not just help these economies. You flood these economies with public money. We're talking, the scale of West Germany, what he wanted, we're talking hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars for each country just to get them on their feet. And he went to America. America said no. Basically, they gave him this tiny bit of change. Not nothing, I mean, but it's like, I think it was something like 25 million, which was like just enough to pave the roads. I don't know, nothing like what he wanted. Creating new systems of school and creating the correct electoral processes, all the things you need to make a new state. Hungary went from communism to democracy in 2 months. Like, what could go wrong? 3 months, March, whatever. But the second point is that what he said, and this is the part that's so profound, he said, look, if you don't do this, it's not just that we're not going to develop. It's that you're going to open all the borders, and there's no work. So where's all the labor going to go? To your countries. In other words, like, think of all this, all the like anti-Polish hatred you still see in the UK, right? Like, I remember I was living here. I had a postdoc at Oxford for a few years. I was living not far from here during the Brexit years. And I remember I was reading into all this stuff kicking up. The old migrant problem, the new one is Syrians and Africans and et cetera. The old one was, in fact, Eastern Europeans. If you read about and again, I'm speaking about your country that I'm not a specialist in. But it happened across the West. It happened in France, it happened in Spain, it happened in Italy. All these people went looking for work because the borders were open and there was nothing creating jobs back east. And he basically said, it's going to change your demographics and it's going to change your politics. He didn't use the word populism or xenophobia. He didn't use any of that language. He's an economist. He's saying all your labor markets are going to be saturated by us because you don't spend any time now building up these economies themselves. And so, you know, here he is, the boxer in the ring, still litigating these points 30 years later because he's so sad that, like, everything you're seeing, again, there's this rupture point, and you really can, you know, it's like a good detective story, like an Agatha Christie, right? Where there's like, you know, in the end, Poirot is going to solve the murder, right? But the link from page 1 to page 200, you don't see coming. He saw it coming. So to be at the end, he's just there, sad and out of power. That's where Nemeth is. He doesn't like that depiction of him, but whatever.
Question over there.
Thank you for a fascinating talk. You mentioned that the picnic, thousands literally of East Germans took advantage of the situation. What about the Poles, the Czechoslovaks, the Romanians, and the others behind the curtain? Were there any of them there?
Absolutely, but in way smaller numbers. Because there's a historical precedent to it. So you could travel anywhere in the socialist East, right? That it wasn't like you couldn't, it's like if you were a Pole, you couldn't go to Spain, but you could go to Hungary. You still had to get a visa. But historically, it's not where Poles went. It really was a place where Germans went. So for Germans to get a visa for the summer vacation to go to Hungary, raise no eyebrows. And before the news, there was already so many plans to go to Hungary. So just the relationship was different. The density of people was different. But you find Bulgarians, you find all, totally, the whole panoply. But even for you find Latvians and Lithuanians, and there was a lot of people. But we're talking eight out of 10 are East Germans.
Thank you. If the picnic hadn't happened, would the Berlin Wall still have come down?
Oh, God, the counterfactual. Sure. I think it's about the way things happen, right? I mean, even at the picnic, think of how fine the line is between bloodshed and this euphoria. There's, like, in each of these instances, you can thread the story, to go back to the Agatha Christie, I don't know why I'm talking about Agatha Christie, but this idea that you can thread a story, it doesn't mean it's the only version. And so what other route to the Berlin Wall falling or it staying up, I wouldn't even know how to begin. Counterfactuals are a mess, right? In the tiny little instances that I researched, every single step could have gone wrong in 10 ways. So would it have stayed up? Frankly, I mean, these were slow-moving economy collapses. So if you look at reports from... to give you an idea, so I don't know how many of you waste your time in like CIA reports, but if you're interested, if you look at the CIA conflict assessments, they're all open now because it's more than 30 years, of what they thought was the truth, right? This is CIA internal assessment of the truth, risk scenarios. We're talking about all these countries. They didn't see it happening, so much so they didn't trust, they didn't think anything was real about the reform or Gorbachev. All these things that now there's this like air of inevitability. We talk about it. Like the Berlin Wall had to fall. Soviet Union had to collapse. It's a kind of, you could stay on for 50 more years in a slow state of horrible collapse. Or you can turn into a bloody coup or a civil war, all these things. All I can say is I know from the vantage of that moment, from all these different perspectives, how unbelievably surprising it was that it happened the way it did, right? And to give you the evidence, look, I can give you the kind of CIA type of evidence. The real evidence in my world, again, I'm storytelling. This is an interview project, right? It's an oral history book. These East Germans, like, they fled across the border with their kids, right? Because they felt that the risk of them dying at the Iron Curtain was more palatable than forcing them to grow up in a world in which they had no freedom. If you knew the Berlin Wall was even plausibly going to fall, nevertheless, 2 months later, you would never subject your children to, like, the death strip, right? So there is some way in which I believe the counterfactual story, it would have taken way longer. To give you two quotes from the book that get into this, when you asked the picnic organizers what they thought about it leading to this kind of change, one of them, this kind of Laszlo is a quote I like, where he said, "Oh, we knew the picnic would be important. We just thought you'd need 1,000, right? Like, they thought this was the beginning of years. But the more interesting one comes from Arpad Bella. Arpad Bella is the border guard. And to give you the context of people bringing their children, this is the man that stood in front of the hordes in a field just like this one and stepped aside and let them pass, right? I met him several times. You sit with him and you ask why. I'm interested in that, the moral decision-making. We can vilify these actors. He's the bad guy, right? He's the border guard from the communist state. He's not anyone's idea of the hero of the story until he becomes that because he's moral. You ask him, why did you do it that way? Why didn't you at least shoot into the air, do something to stop them? And his answer was, they were not enemies. They had prams, right? That's how many children we're talking about. Seeing a horde, what he saw was just families and kids. None of that's plausible if you thought it was even a possibility it would crash soon. So I think that if I had to answer a counterfactual question, which, you know, is always scary of history, I think the answer is probably just later. and maybe bloodier. But I mean, I have no idea. We have 5 minutes left.
What happened to Fedesh? Thank you.
Fedens. So Fedens is the opposite of Nemeth. Nemeth, who's still in it in his mind, in his like 70s, you have this image of him like in the shower. He doesn't like sing. He like re-narrates speeches he would have given. Like, I mean, he's that kind of guy. He hasn't had a single different thought in 30 years. Like, he's completely. Fedens is the opposite. Fedens did his thing. He was in it for the party. He was thrilled. He now lives in an art park. Like, imagine a little garden of a house, but there's not really a house. It's like a shed. In the whole thing is a garden filled with art he made. And all the stones and the trees are painted with quotes from Nietzsche, which I quote in the book because they're so amazing. He did his thing. He's really more of the, like, this was his activist thing. And he wanted the freedom to think differently, right? And he got his way, and now he's an artist, and that's his life. His girlfriend's a poet. They recite poetry to each other every night before bed. They're quite lovely people. Last questions.
Any more questions?
If there isn't, tiny little note. Apparently, I'm now to go to the Waterstones to sign books. Just so you know, because you're now in on the secret, the border and the border guard, Arpad, I have his passport stamp, the original passport stamp from 1989. I can stamp books. If you don't want to buy a book, just come with a piece of paper and I'll stamp it for you. It's like totally cool. That's it.